Hi, everybody, and welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo, and are you ready for what will probably be the last episode of Stack Trace for 2022?
You must be careful there. You say the last episode of Stack Trace and suspense. 2022.
You can't wait for too long before you're saying for 2022. We will be back in January 2023,
yeah,
we promise.
Yeah, I'm really excited. It's always fun to be recording Stack Trace. And this is our end of the year special, even though it's not really a special, it's just a regular episode. But hey, I hope people like our regular episodes.
Yeah, I mean, now that we're doing the episodes a little bit more seldomly or not on like this weekly schedule, we thought we would just do like a regular episode, not kind of sum up the year or something, because, well, we have so many interesting things to talk about. So we just want to get those topics out there and talk about them. And then we could, I guess, maybe sum up the year in our first January episode or something, maybe talk about some trends and what we're expecting for the upcoming year. That's always fun to speculate about.
Absolutely.
So, Rambo, let's get right into it. And I want to first start by asking you, what have you been up to? Because we spoke on the last episode about some of your work that you've been doing with Chibi Studio, and you were working on the editor app for the Mac and so on, and you were making some big architectural changes, or considering at least making some larger changes. So how has that all been playing out? And have you been working on other aspects of Chibi Studio, perhaps?
Yeah, so I have done a lot of under-the-hood changes since we last spoke. And it's funny that, so this app has been around since 2016, as we talked about, and the code base, there are things in there that I really don't like, as you might imagine, because it's from a long time ago in programming years, I guess. And I really didn't like a lot of aspects of the code base as I dug into it once again. Like, it's not like I had forgotten everything, but I don't go in so often that I kind of have all of the architecture in my head and all of the bits and pieces. And even though there is that aspect, I still feel like architecturally speaking, it was quite okay for the time when I wrote it, because this was written during like the transition from Swift 3 to Swift 4, and that was not fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like, there were so many things that changed back then, like not only like the whole API naming in Swift and the guidelines being established, but also like major features coming into the language, things like codable, for example, mm-hmm. right? Like, didn't exist before then. So yeah, I can imagine that with all those changes, it also, whenever that something like that happens, it also very much accelerates code turning into quote-unquote legacy code.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have that kind of line in the sand where you have code written before that and after that, and the code written before that starts to feel really old real quick.
Yeah, and it sounds like I wrote the app and never touched it again, which is definitely not the case. Like, it went through a major, almost like a rewrite, but not really. Like, the whole UI had been rewritten for version 2 of the app, but the underlying core technology was still the same. And I mention all of this because even though this was quite an old code base and there were some things that I didn't like about it, I was surprised at how I was able to go in and swap out entire subsystems without having to rewrite major parts of the UI and things like that. So I think I did something right back when I first architected this code base, because yeah, like for example, I replaced the whole inventory system in the app that stores like all of the packs and items that you can use. And it was using core data. And it was basically like a read-only core data database that shipped with the app. And there were some things that I didn't like about using core data for that. Like, core data can be a great tool, but I felt like basically I was using core data for the inventory because it was also used for the user's own library of items, so of chibis that they've created. So the whole user data storage was using core data. And back when I wrote this, I thought, well, might as well use core data for the inventory as well. And these were completely separate data models and on disk storage. They weren't related at all. It was just like a choice of technology informed by what I was already using. So I used core data, but I wasn't really using core data, if you know what I mean. Like, there wasn't like a bunch of complicated querying going on or anything that I was benefiting from using car data. And as I was working on some changes to allow new features and also profiling performance in the app, and not that car data is slow, not at all, but when you have like a collection view like you have in the GB Studio editor with thousands of items and multiple levels of items and things like that, and you're pulling all of that in from car data, and I was probably doing something wrong. I will totally admit to that. I don't know. I profiled it and it was spending most of the time doing car data stuff under the hood that I don't know about. So I was like, what if I what if I just replace the car data stack for this inventory with a plist, like a property list file? So that's what I did, and it was definitely worth it. It took me like half a day to do, so it wasn't like a huge undertaking, and it worked perfectly. And you know what I did as well, John? I wrote tests before I did
all right.
this. So I wrote tests to like replicate the current behavior that the app was doing, because I wasn't trying to fix any bugs. It was just like a replacement of technology. So I thought, well, might as well write some tests to make sure that after I replace this and I run the test, if all of the tests pass, at least hopefully the behavior will be the same. And that worked fantastically.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. And I think that's such a good approach. Like when you're doing any kind of major refactoring or rewrite work, step zero is usually like write tests for it, or make sure that you have good test coverage for the functionality you're looking to rewrite or replace or change in a significant way. And of course, sometimes that can be challenging depending on how well your concerns are separated beforehand. Because like we've mentioned many times on this podcast, like I think one of the most important aspects of any architecture is separation of concerns, because like you just mentioned here, it was relatively easy for you to actually make this quite major change to your architecture in this particular part of the code base because you had already reasonably well separated concerns, right? So that's a very important aspect, I think, for many reasons, for testability, for maintainability, for being able to change your mind in the future, and so on. But related to that as well, I think, is, you know, your discussion there of why did you choose core data versus like now moving to something like a plist, like a more on-disk storage, raw storage that you're just manipulating directly. I think the trade-off there is kind of always power versus complexity, where if you need more power or you need more features and flexibility of a certain piece of functionality like your database or on-disk storage, then going for something like core data or any other kind of database, like proper database, is usually the way to go. Because if you go then for a more simple solution, that can be incredibly difficult to maintain. And you end up basically having to rewrite your own database layer on top of plists, which is not great. But on the other hand, in your use case here, when you just want a simple storage, then you don't need all the complexity that a database comes with, then the trade-off kind of shifts in the other direction, right? Yeah. So I think whenever we're making any kind of technology decision, rather than thinking about what am I currently using in maybe another part of the code base in another subsystem, or what's trendy right now, or what do I already know? Of course, those are also important aspects for consistency and ease of implementation, because if you need to learn something brand new, then that can also slow you down. But I think one of the most important questions that we always have to ask ourselves is, how much power do I need in this particular case? And how much of complexity am I willing to take on in order to achieve that goal of having those powerful features?
Yeah, and if I were to simplify for those who are trying to make such a decision, like I'm not saying that shipping a pre-built core data database in your app bundle is always a bad idea. It might be a great idea depending on what you're doing. Like if you're doing very complicated querying of the data, or if the data set is going to get potentially very large, then yeah, absolutely. Like I probably wouldn't want to store user data as property lists, even though that could be a good solution depending on the use case. But in this case, I don't know how many creations the user will have in their library. Like they might have 50,000 things in their library and they want to search by date or whatnot. And yeah, I can't guarantee that a property list is going to work for that.
Yeah, and in order to make it work for that, you would have to basically invent a database layer on top, right? Yeah. You would have to split the data up into multiple plists, organize them in folders, create your own indices to be able to query them efficiently. Like, you're building a database at that point. Might as well just use a database.
Yeah, exactly. So in this case, it's stuff that ships with the app and that's immutable. So there's no need to have like very efficient writes. Like there aren't writes at all. There are no writes. This is all read-only. And when I looked at what was being done in terms of querying core data for the items, it was basically like grouping them into categories based on some fields and other things like that, like looking up which pack an item belongs to. And I was able to solve all of that with the property list without having to like do like a really long filter operation in Swift and actually go through each item on an array or something like that. So in my property list file, I have like packs by ID, and it's a dictionary of IDs to like the pack dictionary, and this was all done using Codable. I have items by pack ID, which points from pack ID to item ID. I have items by category ID. So I basically built my own index in a sense.
Right.
And since this is immutable, like it's very simple to just do these very fast dictionary lookups at runtime and it all works just fine. And the file size, which is also a concern because I do like to keep the app as small as possible, the file size is like 800 kilobytes. So even if it grows a lot, I would be comfortable with this file growing to like 2 megabytes and that would be perfectly fine. But yeah, and then it has like, I don't know, like 5,000 items in the inventory as it is. So yeah, it was a good decision in the end.
Awesome. Glad to hear it. And another option that is worth considering in situations like this, when you want to create like a read-only data set for an application that is generated offline, if you will, like is generated while you build the app, is to actually use code generation and to generate Swift source code that is just returning your resources directly. And the trade-off there is that you add more code to your code base. So depending on the size of your data set, like in this case that you're mentioning, if you have 800 kilobytes worth of resources, that would probably result in a lot of source code being generated and therefore slowing down your compile times, potentially making your app binary even larger because, you know, that's actual source code that needs to be compiled and integrated and so on. But for smaller data sets, that's something that I've done in the past where I basically just written a script that loops through the resources and just generates like Swift read-only properties, like computed properties or methods for those resources. And a huge benefit of that approach is that you get great performance, right?
Yeah.
Because it's actual just static code that is being called. So you can just do it very, very quickly. You don't need to do any kind of lookups on disk or something like that. It's all in the binary. But like I mentioned, like there are concerns there regarding the actual compilation time and source code size, but also memory usage as well. Like if you have everything defined as, for example, static properties, those are lazily evaluated perhaps, but that will still be adding things to your binary when it's loaded into memory. So there are memory concerns there, especially as the data size grows. So it always, like we say, it depends, but also here it depends on what's the size of the data set, even if both of them are read-only.
Yeah, this reminds me a lot of some hacks that game developers do where you will basically have a lookup table of calculations that are expensive to do but are cheap to just look up, basically. And this was my philosophy going into this project. I basically checked like the types of lookups that were happening at runtime in the iOS app and thought about ways to bake those lookups into the actual inventory data so that they would become just dictionary lookups instead of like filtering or sorting and stuff like that. And I also took the opportunity to use your great library and rewrote the, well, not actually rewrote because I didn't have to rewrite much things, but basically adapted the macOS app that exports this inventory to do it in parallel. So instead of going like through each pack in like a serial fashion, it does all of them concurrently and spits out the manifest at the end. And I don't remember the exact numbers. I shared them on my Mastodon, but it was like from 60 seconds down to like 10 seconds or something. It was in that order of magnitude in terms of how much faster it is now to build all of the inventory from all of the pack files that we have.
Yeah, that's super cool because that's like a really, really parallelizable problem, right? It's similar to when I made publish use, and I think the package you're referring to is collection concurrency kit, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When I made publish use that, it also significantly increased the performance because you can just generate like HTML files. In my case, like, you know which files you need to generate, you just need to generate them. So it's like a very, very parallelizable problem. So you can just end up like generating a large number of files at the same time concurrently, and then kind of just be notified when everything is done, and then you can just move on to the next generation step in my case.
Yeah, you don't want to look at like the Xcode CPU thing and see it stuck at 100%. You want to see it at like 800%. That's the good number.
Exactly. Use all those cores.
Exactly. And besides that work, and by the way, I have managed to decrease the size of the inventory within the app bundle from like something like 80 megabytes to like 50, but I'm not ready to talk about exactly what I did. So we'll leave that cliffhanger here for another episode. But I'm also working on our paywall, and this was inspired by an episode of Under the Radar with Marco Arment and David Smith, where David was talking about his A/B tests for his paywall in WidgetSmith. And I was actually, for a long time, thinking about doing some tests with the Chibi Studio paywall, because we changed it in an app update, which I don't remember exactly which update that was, but we changed our paywall in an update, and it wasn't easy to spot at the time, but looking at the numbers in hindsight, it feels like since that paywall change, our conversion has gone way down in terms of how many people are doing the in-app purchases. So I think there's a correlation.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So it's interesting to hear talk about A/B testing, because I know you work on this app by yourself together with the artist you work with, but you're the only programmer on the project. And when people hear A/B testing, usually I think, you know, you're thinking about larger companies doing that have like a large scale, and they have big infrastructure for creating A/B tests, for following that up with analytics and data, and being very kind of data-driven in their approach. But smaller companies and indie developers perhaps don't tend to utilize A/B testing as much. So I'm interested to hear, like, what does your infrastructure setup look like for A/B testing here? And what were your kind of process for making improvements here to the paywall?
Yeah, definitely. I do have quite a bit of experience doing A/B testing because I used to work for an e-commerce company for their iOS app. So as you might imagine, a fairly large e-commerce company will do a lot of A/B testing. So that's where like I learned how A/B tests work and how you read the numbers and things like that. But what I'm doing for Chibi Studio is, as you might imagine as well, quite different from what a big company might be doing. And I think, and they do go into this in that Under the Radar episode that I mentioned, so we'll definitely leave a link to that if you want to listen to that. But a lot of indie developers, they look at this sort of work with a bit of, I'm not sure if spite is the right word, but like it feels kind of gross, right?
It feels like big company stuff, right? Like enterprise software.
Yeah, exactly. So it feels wrong to some extent, or I don't know the exact, but you feel kind of about it. And we definitely have had that since the beginning of working in the app, because both me and the artist who worked with me, we don't really like the money grab, like casino type apps. And I think that's true of most, if not all, indie developers. We don't like those sorts of apps because, well, first of all, they're doing something that we feel like is wrong or objectionable, at least. And those types of apps, they make people look at apps that ask for money all with the same ill intent, basically. They're doing something to just grab money from me, and it's a scam and whatnot. I feel like every indie developer who has an app that has in-app purchases has probably had at least one app review saying that, oh, this app is a scam, they want your money or something like that. And And I don't blame people for feeling that way because there are so many scammy apps in the App Store. But at the same time, like, we need to keep the app maintainable and we need to make it so it makes sense for us to keep maintaining the app and working on it. So I don't feel bad about optimizing, not in the sense of like using bad patterns where like you put up a paywall without a close button or something. good patterns just to make it as smooth as possible for people to want something and get it. I feel like that's our role and that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, and I think there's a very big difference between removing friction and being sort of dishonest or being manipulative, right?
Yeah.
Like, you want the experience to be smooth and you don't want to make it unnecessarily complicated or harder to actually pay for the app, because if you have users that are happy with your app and they want to pay for it to get more value out of it, well, that's fantastic. Everybody wins, right?
Yep.
And that's very different from like being very manipulative and like tricking people into getting like a subscription that renews every week for some simple app that, you know, doesn't maybe warrant that. So I think there's a spectrum here of how you can implement things. And I think as long as you're being honest and upfront and what you're doing is really in the service of your users ultimately, because like you said, like if you don't get enough revenue from this project, well, you will just prioritize other projects and that won't be great for your users anyway, right? So you need to strike a nice balance between making a project profitable while still making it nice to use. And I think, you know, there are so many ways to make those both of those things be true. You can definitely have something be profitable and a great business, but still be a fantastic product to use.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, it is going to be some level of annoying at some point. Like, if you ever go to a shop or you're watching TV or something and there's like a salesperson, salespeople are always going to be some level of annoying because they have to. It's their job.
They have to get your attention, right?
Yeah, and they have to be annoying at the same time convincing you that they're not, basically, which is a great skill that I definitely don't have. I'm just annoying and that's it. So I am trying to do that. And the two main things we are trying are, first of all, increase paywall visibility. So basically, we want to make more people end up in the paywall, which sounds absolutely awful, and I feel terrible for saying this, but basically what we gathered from looking at numbers and also from feedback from fellow developers and even from an app review rejection once is that our paywall is kind of hidden. Like, we don't really surface it as much as we probably should. So basically, the only way in Chibi Studio for you to see a paywall, or at least that was the only way until like a few months ago, but that's unrelated. So the only way is for you to be like working on your Chibi in the editor, and there is the drawer with all of the items. And the only way for you to see the paywall is if you tap an item that's part of a paid pack. And that's the only way for you to see the paywall. And we had like people, I had like some fellow developers try out the app and asked for feedback, and more than one person said like, where's the paywall? How do I get to it? And we actually got a rejection from app review once because the person who was doing the app review couldn't find the paywall. They were like, I'm trying to find your in-app purchases and I can't find them in the app. Where are they? I can't review them. And we had to explain, oh, you have to go and tap an item that says premium on it. So, yeah, it's definitely too hidden and we have to increase its visibility somehow.
Yeah, but I kind of get why you went for that implementation because it makes sense, right? Yep. Like the time when you ask for users to pay for the app is when they want to do something that requires payment, right? Mm-hmm. So that makes total sense. And I think this also goes back to what we just said. You want to provide a good user experience and you know, from that perspective, like being able to just use the app kind of unobstructed if you don't want to access any of those premium items is very nice for the user, right? Yep. But then on the other hand of that, the downside, like I'm sure you're going to talk about now, is it just makes it harder for people to discover what you can actually pay for. And maybe there are a lot of users out there who would be super happy to pay for the app because they love the app and they want to support it and they want to get more value from it. But they just haven't discovered how to do that.
Yeah, definitely. And that's absolutely the case. So We're thinking about several things, but the first thing we did was to reorganize the way items are presented in the drawer. So before, the sorting was such that all of the free items would be on top, and you'd have to scroll all the way down to start seeing the premium items. And that was in our philosophy of, and it's still our philosophy, that we want users to be able to have a lot of fun with the app without ever buying anything. And that's a philosophy of not wanting to be like one of those money-grabbing apps, and also a philosophy of there's children who use the app, because it's an app that appeals to children as well. And we don't want children to like be pestering their parents about buying something in our app. We don't want any of that. So that's also a consideration. And I'm actually looking into a way to hide all in-app purchases from the app if the device is like a child device. I'm not sure if there's API for that. I'm looking into it. If anyone knows, please let me know. So we do think about a lot about that sort of thing. We have schools using the app as well. And we tried releasing a school edition, but they didn't want that. They just got the regular app instead. So yeah. And of course, schools are not going to be buying the in-app purchase, because there isn't even like a volume program for in-app purchases from Apple. It's just for prepaid apps. So yeah, first of all, we reorganized the items in the drawer so that I believe it's based on... So the main grouping is by category. So face, hair, torso, and things like that. And then within each category, they are grouped by specific types. So like there's eyes, there's beards and glasses and things like that. And before, we would push all of the premium stuff down, and now they just show up in line within their category.
Yeah, that sounds good. Like, that sounds like a nice mixture between providing a good user experience while still surfacing the premium content, right?
Yep.
So that you're not hiding it at the bottom, but also you're not like pushing all of the premium items right to the top and then you have to scroll down to find the free stuff. You're kind of like creating a more natural sorting of things, like sorting by the actual order of the items rather than whether they're premium or not.
Yeah, basically before it would do the same sorting, but it would do it in two groups, the locked items and the unlocked items, and then the locked items will be at the bottom, and now it just sorts all of them all at once, and that's it. We do still want to do some work in the drawer for it to be easier for people to find the stuff they want, because it's kind of like the problem with the emoji picker in a sense. And we are considering adding metadata to each item so that they are searchable. But that's going to be a huge undertaking for just two guys. That's a lot of work.
Maybe you can train like a machine learning model to actually like look at the different items and generate keywords based on those. And then you could go in and like just edit them and see, you know, did the machine learning program actually generate good metadata? That would be so easy, Rambo. Just do that, like a few hours of work, right?
Just use AI.
Just use AI.
Yeah, so it's funny you say that, because I do actually have data about items that are often used together. We purposefully grabbed that with analytics, completely anonymous, no user identifiable stuff, just like these hashes are used with these hashes. And I do have the data, and I tried to train a machine learning model to suggest recommended items, like a genius suggestion for items for your chibi. And it didn't work very well when I tried it first, but maybe I'll try it again, because I think this stuff has evolved a lot, especially for ML newbies like I am. So that is an area I'm willing to explore. And we're also considering adding like a new tab to the main app where you can see all of the premium content in the app and like maybe try it out, or like see some creations made with each one of the packs, and also a little banner in the library tab, which is where it lists all of your own creations. So I feel like that's all stuff that's going to increase the visibility of the paywall without compromising on the app experience too much.
Yeah, that sounds really, really good. So you mentioned earlier that your approach to A/B testing is different at a different scale compared to when you were working for a large company. So how does your actual like infrastructure work? Like, how is this all set up in code? How do you know whether a given user should see this part of the A/B test or not?
So I am planning, and again, this is all speculative. I haven't shipped any of this yet, and it might change. I'll let everyone know if it changes. And of course, I'll let everyone know the results after we've been able to ship this and test it for a while. But the main focus for the A/B test will be the actual paywall screen itself. So I mentioned that we felt a correlation between a change in the paywall design and conversion rate going down. And I want to put up the original paywall screen, so the one that's out there right now, against a new base design that's very much a simplification of the original one, because looking at the testing that David was doing with WidgetSmith, I noticed that our paywall screen is just too complicated. Like, there's too much stuff, and I feel like it looks great. There's like a really nice transition, because when you open it up from a premium item, like the item you selected flies into the paywall screen, into a carousel, like a 3D-ish looking carousel of all of the items in the pack, in the header, and there's like a really nice animation, all of that, which you might expect from something I'm doing.
Absolutely.
And it's nice. It looks nice, but I think there's just too much stuff in that. Like, there's too much screen real estate being used by that item carousel. There's two call to actions with the same weight. So we have each individual pack is a different non-consumable in-app purchase. So you have like the K-pop pack and like the hair styles or something like that pack. And each one of them is a separate in-app purchase for like 99 cents or $1.99. I think the most expensive one is like $2.99. But we also have what we call the lifetime pack, which is the in-app purchase that unlocks everything forever, basically. So you get all of the existing stuff plus anything we released after. And that one is like, I think, like $20. So it is pricey, but it's way cheaper than getting each individual pack. And with the current paywall, it shows you the price for the current pack, that for the item that you selected. And there's like the get button that looks kind of like the App Store get button, just larger and pink, which is the color of the app. And there's another like unlock all button, and they look the same. Like, the unlock button is a little bit wider because it needs to be to fit the text, but they have the same weight, basically. So what I am doing now, and I have shared stuff on my Mastodon, we'll leave a link in the show notes, is a way simpler. Like, we're actually using the promotional in-app purchase icons, the ones you can ship to the App Store that show up in the app page. We're using those icons as like the main visual element on that paywall screen. It shows the name of the pack, a short description, and then there's like a big capsule-shaped buy button at the bottom. And there's, of course, like the little restore purchases button, which is way smaller, and there's, of course, the price. And also below the price, there's the disclaimer one-time purchase, because so many people expect stuff to be a subscription these days and they want to make it clear that it's a one-time purchase. So the main experiment to begin with will be between this simplified paywall and the control, which is basically the current one that's on the app. And then I want to experiment with a few things within the new paywall, assuming it does better than the old one. And those things I'm still figuring out, but it's probably going to have to do with the call to action on the actual button. So right now it says buy name of the pack, so buy hairstyles pack or something. I want to experiment with like other types of words, like instead of buy, use get, because maybe some people might be put off by the buy word, I don't know, and different like arrangements, and maybe like add some other visual element to that screen. So that's stuff I'm still figuring out. But another thing you want to experiment with is to, instead of offering people the individual packs, is to only offer the lifetime purchase, which we won't call lifetime anymore. We're still thinking about it, but we may be calling it like Chibi Studio Premium or Chibi Studio Plus or something. And we're probably going to make it less expensive as well. But yeah, that's another experiment I want to do. So those are the like initial tests that I'm planning on doing. And in terms of actual infrastructure, I already have a feature flags system that I wrote using CloudKit. And there's a blog post on my blog with basically all of the overview of how this feature flag system works. And my plan is to use that system to do the A-B test. And I know this is not really an A-B test, because my plan is to, instead of do the A-B tests concurrently in parallel, I'm going to do them in sections. So basically, like, I'll turn on this version of the paywall for 15 days or a week, I don't know how much time, and then I'll switch to the other one and compare, and then do other tests after that. I know that's not ideal. Like, ideally, for A-B testing, you want to be doing in parallel, so you want some percentage of users to be seeing something and another percentage to be seeing another thing. But this way is just way simpler to do. And I don't want to use like a big library, because I don't feel like it's necessary. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. Do you think that's a terrible idea?
Not really. Like, I mean, you're avoiding the whole complexity of having to do what's called bucketing, right? Yeah. Which is to create different buckets of users where, you, like you mentioned, you will say a certain percentage will get this implementation, another percentage will get this one, and then you usually have a control group. So maybe you have, let's say, two or three different variants of the different experiments you want to run, and then you have a control group, which is very important to have, because that's how you can compare not only the result of the experiments between each other, but also to the current production version that you're shipping right now. And if you don't do that comparison, well, then you can end up with really strong false positives, where it seems like one solution is clearly the winner, but actually it was a regression compared to what you currently have in production, which is more common than you might think if you haven't done any A-B testing, because sometimes when you do A-B testing, you'll be very surprised by the results. And part of that is also that, you know, users get used to something after a little while usually. So, you know, if you take something like, let's say, the Google homepage, right? Like, yeah, that has basically been the same forever since it came out. Because if they would make a huge change to that, that would upset millions, if not billions, of users around the world, right? Like, yeah, they have this muscle memory of going to Google and just typing in a query. So depending on what you're building, you might have users who are incredibly, like, they have built up habits around a certain UI or a certain flow in your app. And if you then change that, well, that could be difficult to actually like get people to be more productive with that straight away. And that's something I think you have to take into account when you're doing A-B testing. But to answer your question, I don't think it's necessarily a terrible idea. I think at your scale, you know, being a single developer working on this, it makes a lot of sense to just use simple Boolean feature flags, turn it on, off, check the results. It might not be as scientifically accurate as if you would do another more kind of sophisticated approach. But for your purposes, I'm sure it's going to be good enough, because as long as you know, plan things out and have a good schedule and you don't run one of the experiments for like 2 days and another for 2 weeks, then I think you'll be fine.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also another challenge is we don't have millions of users. So if you have millions of users, you can definitely do bucketing where you have like only 10% of your user base trying out a feature. But in the case of Chibi Studio, it would definitely have to be 50-50 probably. And even then, it would be a sample set that we would have to run this for quite a while in order to get good data out of it. So of course, if I'm not running them in parallel, we do run the risk of like the seasonality influencing the results and things like that. So I definitely agree that it's not scientific to any stretch of the imagination, but I think for our needs, this will be more than enough. And of course, if we are doing this, we do need the data. So we do need analytics to let us know, like, people who are using this particular version of the paywall are having this particular conversion rate. And I was looking into ways of doing it, and I actually found a new thing that I really like, and unsurprisingly, it's a thing by Cloudflare, not a sponsor. We always have to put this disclaimer, but I really love the work they do, and I use their Workers platform extensively. And they recently released, in beta still, but it's good enough for my needs, the Workers Analytics Engine. And it's quite simple to use when you are already used to the whole Workers thing. You basically like send it a bunch of numbers and data points, and it will aggregate stuff for you. And you can query it using an API, which accepts a simplified SQL query language. And that's it. That's more than enough. So I basically send the version of the paywall that the user is using, and whether they tapped the buy button and whether they converted, so they actually purchased the item. So that's how I track conversion rate. And I'm using the Grafana tool running on a Docker container, where I hooked it up to that analytics engine database, and it has a little table where it shows me like how many people have tapped the buy button and how many people have purchased and the conversion rate and whatnot. So that will be my way of actually tracking the conversion. And it's great because I'm not paying a huge amount of money for it. I only have like the basic $5 a month Workers plan from Cloudflare. And the whole analytics thing, I don't think they're charging for it yet because it's a beta. Not sure how much it will cost. And what's even better is, so I already had an analytics system of sorts for Chibi Studio that is basically sending stuff to like a Node.js server, and that stores it on a database. But it didn't have the aggregation features that this analytics engine has. So what I've done, and that's how I already have data, because I have shipped an update to that backend where it's sending stuff to the analytics engine. So I didn't even have to ship a new version of the app to start using this new analytics engine.
Oh, that's super cool. It's always great when you can kind of turn your own backend into somewhat of a proxy and then send it to another service. Because like you said, then you don't have to update all the clients and you get like backward compatibility for free. That's like always a big benefit of having, I would say, as much logic as possible server side. Of course, depending on what kind of product you're building and what kind of scale you want to be able to achieve, right? Like when you have stuff on the server, that's always a big question. Like how will that scale according to your number of users? But it just gives you so much flexibility. Like when the logic is on the server, well, you can change it without having to update all of the clients.
Yeah, and we've been talking for like 45 minutes or something, and you just mentioned server-side stuff, and I haven't even mentioned the fact that I wrote a JavaScript and SwiftUI bridge for this experiment. But I don't think we'll have time for that. It will have to be a cliffhanger, because I want to hear about what you have been up to. And if we start talking about this JavaScript and SwiftUI stuff here, I think we'll go on for another hour.
Probably, yeah. That sounds like a super interesting topic. And you have showed me some of the work that you've done regarding this, and it is really, really interesting. And I definitely want to revisit this topic because it's kind of funny. I would say during the past month, I've been speaking to 5 or 6 different people or something like that who have all told me that they're exploring similar things, which is like the whole idea of server-driven UI or pushing more things to the server, like I just mentioned, like having the server send more kind of predefined UI components to the client, whether that's on the web or in an app. So it seems like a topic that is resurfacing again, which as longtime listeners of the show will know, is a very, very big passion of mine, if you will, like having server-driven UI. And I was working at that all the way back at Spotify when I was working there. And since then, I've worked on it several times as well. So I definitely want to explore this topic more with you, Rambo. And I think we could kind of do like an episode talking about this concepts in general, because even though we have talked about it in the past, I think we can give a kind of updated take on, you know, building these kinds of more dynamic UIs that are server-driven, maybe server-driven UIs in 2023.
Definitely. So what have you been up to?
So I've been up to a bunch of different things, of course. I have been doing my freelance work, and I have some things I want to share from that, as always on every episode. I talk about some learnings from my different projects, and I can actually start with that one, because then I have another topic that is quite different, which I also do want to talk about, which is going to be fun.
Nice.
Little cliffhanger, but not for the next episode, I promise. This is going to be on this episode. But just a very quick, like, John's Swift UI corner here, if you will. Like, I usually share tips regarding these things, because I know that there's a lot of developers out there right now who are adopting Swift UI perhaps for the first time, or integrating it inside of different projects, maybe finding different ways to integrate their existing, like, UIKit-based components, or building specific screens with Swift UI, or starting to migrate a project to it, because Swift UI has been out now for a little while, and it's starting to really mature, I think, and also the adoption in the community, I think, is going, I mean, I don't know, I don't have any numbers, but it feels like, just like looking at what people are doing and the types of questions I get and things like that, and workshops that I'm hosting about Swift UI, it really feels like the community is more and more starting to embrace it. And one thing that we're talking about very often when it comes to Swift UI is the interoperability between Swift UI and UIKit. And yeah. I mentioned it many times before that I think is a really important aspect of the framework and can really act as a nice escape hatch for when you can't achieve something in Swift UI, you can go back to UIKit. Well, in this case, I had something really interesting happen, which was I needed to build a layout that was flexible depending on if it was rendered in landscape or portrait. And one way that you can do that with Swift UI is you can dynamically switch between an H stack and a V stack. So you could read something like, let's say you could read the geometry with the geometry reader to check like what is the width and height. You could check the portrait or landscape orientation of the device, or you could check the size class. There's an environment variable for that. So you could check like the horizontal size class of the current UI and then decide, do you render in landscape or portraits? So if you do that, like the very simplest implementation of that in Swift UI would be to check your condition, whatever method you're using, do an if statement. And if you are in the horizontal mode, you then put an H stack there and you put your content inside of the H stack. Or in the else clause, you put a V stack and then put the same content in there as well. So that would be the simplest way to build kind of a dynamic stack that switches between a horizontal and vertical layout. The problem with that approach, though, and I did write an article about this, which we'll put a link to in the show notes so you can read more about the different trade-offs of these solutions. But the problem with this simple solution is that Swift UI will treat these two code branches as completely separate views.
Oh.
And that has problems both in terms of animations. When you want to transition between landscape and a portrait, you just get a crossfade because they are just separate views, right?
Yeah.
And in my use case here, particularly, the problem was around state management. So since in Swift UI, we put so much of our state in our views, either using like at state or at binding, or using at state object and actually putting our like objects inside of our views or injecting them somehow. And that would lead, in my case, to state loss, essentially, where when you would rotate from portrait to landscape, you would get a different state than what you had before, which would be a pretty terrible user experience, right? Yeah. Especially in the kind of app I was working on here, it was really important to preserve that state. Now, one way to get around that would be to move the state upwards in the view hierarchy. So the parent view could hold the state instead, and then give that state to the child views, both the horizontal one and the vertical one. That way, the state would survive those landscape and portrait orientation changes. But in this particular case, I really wanted those to be separate views because there are a lot of details here that I'm not going to go into, but the UIs were significantly different enough that I wanted the state to be inside of those leaf nodes, if you will. I didn't want to move it up the stack. And I also wanted to have good separation of concerns. So I didn't want to leak the state kind of upwards to the parents. So yep. I ruled that out. Well, there's another solution you can go for, which is the new layout protocol, which was introduced in iOS 16, which lets you switch dynamically between H stack and V stack by using their underlying layouts. And I also go through that in the article I just mentioned. And that preserves the view identity, which is great because it preserves your state, it preserves animations. It's really, really good. So if you're using iOS 16 only or forward, then that's a great solution. In my case, though, I had to support all the way back to iOS 14. So that was definitely not a option I could go for.
Yeah.
So I thought about this, like, what can I do here? And like I mentioned, whenever I end up in a situation like this, I usually think, how could I solve this with UIKit? And with UIKit, it would actually be really easy. You would use a UI stack view and just change the axis of the stack view, right? Like it's one property change. And then I just thought, well, why don't I just take my two Swift UI views, I put them in UI hosting controllers, and then I put those hosting controllers views inside of a stack view, and then I change it depending on if it's landscape or portrait, according to the axis, like I just mentioned. And that worked fantastically great. Like that worked exactly as I wanted to. The view state is preserved because the underlying views are still the same because the hosting controllers don't change. The layout will change super nicely and fluidly because the stack view takes care of those rotation animations. And then the underlying Swift UI views will just change their bounds, basically, right? So that will also be super smooth. So it worked really, really well. And I just wanted to bring it up here because it's a reminder that very often we can bring our UIKit-based views into Swift UI and use the Swift UI layout system to do things like animations and frame modifiers and padding and so on. But you can also do the opposite if you need to. You could take Swift UI views, put them in UI hosting controllers, and then use a UI view controller representable to create a view controller that basically lays out those underlying Swift UI views however you want, using auto layout or any other layout mechanism in UIKit. And it just works. And it's another kind of example of how this interoperability is so powerful. And it really, really made it possible for me to build something very simple, actually. Like the line count was very low. I don't remember exactly how many lines, but like something like less than 100 lines, I believe, to achieve this very dynamic layout in a way that is completely backward compatible without having to like say this will only work on iOS 16. So yeah, I was very happy about that solution.
Yeah, that's really nice. And I really want to stress this point again, that using these tools does not mean it's a hack. Like, you're using the interoperability between UIKit and Swift UI in the way it was intended.
Yeah.
Like, I definitely understand that it's possible for you to abuse this sort of thing and definitely try to keep within the bounds of what you feel like is sensible. But I feel like your use case is sensible, and especially if it works, like, it's perfectly fine. I've actually done a bit of interop as well in Chibi Studio because I rewrote the toolbar in the editor, and that toolbar has hover effects for the buttons when you're using an iPad with a trackpad or mouse. And it also has to open up popovers, UIKit popovers, that are completely unrelated to the Swift UI world where the toolbar now lives. And the way I solved that was with a preference key where the toolbar items propagate their frame on screen to the controller that's hosting them. And then I basically wrote a little delegate method for the UI pointer interaction that returns the right rectangles. And for the popover, I did the same thing and it just worked. Just a little bit of frame conversion, and it was all good. And again, it was also like not even 50 lines of code.
Yeah, it's one of those things where coming up with the solution is the hard part. Actually implementing it is usually relatively straightforward once you know what to do.
Yeah.
And you know how these mechanisms work, like the preferences system, for example. When you initially see it, like this kind of code, it might seem quite confusing. Like you have to attach a preference modifier to your view, and then you have to observe it, and you have to have a state and so on. So there are some moving parts, but the actual line count is very, very low. And I will definitely re-emphasize what you just said there, which is like, this is not a hack in the sense that I really think we need to separate between using APIs that are fully supported that might end up with a solution that is somewhat more complex than it would be if you would only, for example, use Swift UI. But it's definitely not a hack. Like a hack is when you will use unsupported features or make assumptions that might not be true and do that like knowingly because you need to achieve something, which you sometimes need to do. Like sometimes you do need to have these hacks in your code base. But in this case, we're talking about using officially supported API, like the interoperability APIs, the UI view controller representable. That's not a hack. That's an officially supported API that works really, really well. And also Apple themselves make a lot of use of throughout the operating system and Swift UI itself. Like many of Swift UI views are still actually represented by UIKit components under the hood using the same interop. So definitely not a hack. But of course, whenever you're mixing technologies, it's important to kind of establish some good boundaries so you don't let the implementation details leak too much between the layers, because like we talked about, separation of concerns is super important. But if you do it that way and you kind of keep the Swift UI code in the land of Swift UI and you create this just like in between layer that translates between the two, and then the UIKit code can be fully implemented in UIKit, then I think you end up with a super nice approach.
Yeah, definitely. If you want to see what an actual Swift UI hack looks like, we'll leave a link in the show notes to one in my Virtual Buddy project where I had to allow keyboard navigation in a view. But when you do that on macOS, it draws a focus ring around the view, and the focus ring didn't look good, and there's no way to customize it in Swift UI. So I had like an invisible rectangle that takes focus, and that's what's doing the event propagation. And it worked. It's an empty hidden overlay with an on move command. And it's always in focus, but that is a hack, I'll admit that. There's even a horrible hack comment in the code.
Nice. And don't get me wrong, I have those as well, like all across my Swift UI projects. I mean, not all across in the sense that every single view is a hack, but I do make some hacks here and there knowingly that I will have to check this every time Apple updates the operating system to make sure that this is still working. But that was just like, I needed to do that to achieve what I wanted to achieve. And I couldn't, like in this particular case where I didn't have the time to like drop down to UIKit and re-implement the whole thing. So the hack was the pragmatic solution in that case. But I try to avoid hacks like that as much as possible. And I definitely prefer going back to UIKit instead of like making too many assumptions about the way Swift UI works under the hood and having to like have separate implementations for example, iOS 14, 15, and 16. I would then prefer to just have a single UIKit-based implementation for that particular view that just works across all operating systems.
Yeah, and pro tip, if you do these sorts of hacks in Swift UI, a great way to hide them is to write a custom view modifier. Then you hide your hack in the view modifier, and you never have to look at it again.
Perfect. That is until it breaks when Apple updates the operating system, right?
That is true, yeah. But it's also a great way to revisit. Like you have the hack something view modifier, and you know that you should probably revisit that when new API comes along.
Right, exactly.
So what other thing have you been up to? Because I know what it is, but I think our listeners will be surprised, and I think it's going to be a fun topic.
Absolutely. So I have a new project here sitting right next to me here in the office. It is a new computer.
Ooh.
And this computer is actually, it's not a Mac, oh, which is probably going to surprise a lot of people. And I built it myself.
Wow.
Because I have actually built my own computer. I have built my own gaming PC for playing games. And I built it from scratch. I mean, I didn't create my own processor and my own graphics card, but
silicone.
I assembled it myself, right? I didn't set up my own manufacturing for chips and so on. I didn't do any of that.
Sundell Silicon Incorporated.
Right. Not at that level yet, but I did learn so many things about like how computers are assembled. It was such a fun project to put together. Like doing months and months of research about not only like how do you actually build a computer, but like what part should I use? What are the different trade-offs in terms of performance, and how can I make sure that all of these components interoperate? Like speaking about interoperability, right? Like that's incredibly important when you're talking about components. And it was just such a fun journey to go through, and something I probably didn't think I would ever do. If you would have asked me, let's say like maybe a year ago, like would I ever like play games on a PC? I would probably say no way, because not only have I been a Mac user for like years and years and years, but I've also been like a console gamer for more or less my whole life. Like I love playing video games and it's one of my most major hobbies, but I've more or less always been playing games on different consoles up until today. But I did make the decision to build a gaming PC, and I did that, and it's been really, really fun.
So what was the main reason for you to decide to do that and not like abandon the console gaming scene, but moving over to the PC a bit more?
So it all kind of started with the launch of the latest generation of consoles, which came out in 2020. So that's the Xbox Series S and X and the PlayStation 5. And I have the Xbox Series X, and I've been super happy with it. But with this latest generation, there has been some interesting changes in the way games are developed and released, where still to this day, even though we're now like over 2 years from the launch of those latest consoles, a lot of games, I would say the majority of games, are still being developed as kind of cross-gen titles, as people usually refer to, which means that they both ship on the latest generation of consoles and the previous generation. So you can get a lot of new games that are coming out now and play them on like your PlayStation 4 or your Xbox One, so like the previous generation of consoles. And the way that has influenced games is a few different ways. And for me, having the Xbox Series X, which is like the latest console from Microsoft and the most powerful one, what that has meant is that I have usually been able to play games with the best settings you can get on a console and with the best frame rates you can get on a console. And very often you can also choose these days when you're playing games, whether you want to optimize for performance, so you want to run at like 60 frames per second, or you want to have the best graphical quality. And because of that kind of cross-gen nature of games these days, I could usually like play at, let's say, 60 frames per second with good graphics. Like maybe not the best graphics, that if I wanted that, I would have to drop down to 30 frames per second, but I could play with like really good quality and still get a smooth experience. And related to that also is that a lot of previous generation games have been remastered to run at higher frame rates or with better graphics. So what that meant for me in the end is that I've been playing for the last 2 years the vast majority of my games on console at 60 frames per second with like really, really smooth frame rates and still with great graphics. So I've sort of become used to that. And the problem is that now that the generation is kind of well underway, a lot of games are now being developed only for the latest generation of consoles, so only for the Xbox Series S and X and the PlayStation 5. And that has meant that either there's now only a 30 frames per second mode on console, so I can't get my sweet 60 frames per second anymore, and, or rather, there's a lot of compromises in the 60 frames per second mode, where there's like the resolution is way lower, the graphics are way lower, to a way where I really, really notice it, and I feel like it really makes for a subpar experience. So all of this kind of boils down to me feeling that I want to still be able to play with smooth frame rates, because it's kind of similar to when you get like an iPhone or an Apple product with a ProMotion display. Like, you get really used to that fluidity. So if you then go back to an older product, it still works and you can still use it and it's still nice, but the smoothness is not really there, right, Rambo?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like if you, and I am definitely not equipped to talk about the subject in like an authoritative way, so let me know if I'm saying something stupid, but I feel like if you build like a high-end PC, like in your case, isn't it going to have more longevity than your average latest generation gaming console?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, so that's really kind of what made me feel like I wanted to instead build a gaming PC, because I felt like I want to be able to make more choices regarding how I want my gaming experience to be. Like, some games, for example, that I want to play that were older titles, they had never been updated to use the latest console. So they were still running with lower settings, like, and lower frame rates. And I felt like, you know, I know that this game can run on my new console, but it just hasn't been updated. But if I instead look at the PC version, I could run at not only 60 frames, but 120 frames per second, which my TV supports. And I could get like a very, very smooth experience with the great graphics. And like you said, have more longevity, not just because I can have more powerful hardware, but because I can tailor the experience depending on what hardware I have. So, for example, a few years from now, I might choose to say, well, let me reduce the shadow quality in the game and then still get great graphics and great performance, but and still be able to use my hardware. But on a console level, I'm not able to tweak things that much. I can only pick, like, do I want performance mode or quality mode? That's it.
Yeah.
And of course, the trade-off there is that, you know, some people don't really like to do that kind of tinkering, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, they just want to be able to turn on the console and play. And I get that. I've been like that kind of gamer for most of my life. But now, especially also as I've been learning more about how games are actually developed, I'm more interested in it myself. I am doing game development myself in my spare time. I feel like I do want to be able to tweak those settings and get like the, not just the maximum performance, but to be able to tweak things to get the kind of experience I want, to be able to either prioritize frame rate and fluidity or graphical quality, like depending on the game.
Yeah, and another aspect of tweaking is that you can actually tweak the hardware itself, right? So if in a few years there's a new game that you don't feel is going to run well enough on your hardware, you can tweak the hardware. Of course, that's more complicated and expensive, but at least you have that option.
Yeah, because one thing that was really eye-opening in this process is that everything is completely modular, right?
Yeah.
Like when you're buying a modern Mac, you have some options. Like you can choose, like, do I want like the GPU with all the GPU cores intact? Do I want the more powerful CPU? Do I want the M1 Pro or the M1 Max or Ultra? You have some choices, but most of those choices, or all of those choices, I would say, they're fixed, right? You can't change your mind later. And especially annoying is the RAM, right? you can just pick the RAM once and then it's just soldered onto the chip and you can't ever change it. And the eye-opening thing here for me was like, I was looking at what RAM to get and how much of it, and I was still in the kind of Apple consumer mindset, which was like, I have to make sure I have enough RAM for the next 5 years. But I don't, because if I need more RAM later, I can just put more RAM in my PC. Like, it's really great. So that was definitely like a big shift in mindset, which was like, since I now have full modularity, I definitely want to future-proof the system, but I can also leave some things out. I can say, you know, maybe I don't have to buy like the biggest SSD I can get. Maybe I can buy a medium-sized one and then later upgrade it if I need to. Or in this case, I got 32 gigabytes of RAM. Even though I have 2 spare RAM slots now, I could add more RAM to. So I could just upgrade that in the future if I feel like I'm being RAM constrained, which I'm definitely not at the moment. So I think, you know, 32 was definitely good enough for now, but that might change in the future. And I have that option now to really change things. I could even completely replace my CPU if I wanted to. But of course, you know, you don't want to change the components too often because, like you said, they're expensive. It's quite a lot of work to actually like remove a CPU and remove the whole cooling system around it and then put it back again, but it's doable and you can do it. And that's also a really exciting aspect of this.
So how did you go about doing your research and actually building the PC? Because I feel like this is the sort of area where you are probably going to find a lot of conflicting suggestions online. Like there's people who are going to say that thing X is the best way to go, and other people are going to say that thing Y is the best way to go, and they will both have very reasonable arguments for their position. So how did you navigate this unknown territory, or at least partially unknown?
Yeah, it was a very unknown territory for me, to be honest, because like I said, I've been mostly kind of ignoring PC gaming for most of my life. I've been playing on console and I've been a Mac user. So I haven't really been paying that much attention to the PC space apart from like being a curiosity and sometimes checking out like what's the latest graphics card and how does that all work, because I find it interesting to see like the progress of technology. But it was really, really like difficult in the beginning to know like who should I trust, right? what should I go for? Because also like there's so many choices, like every single component that you want to put in the computer, whether it's the processor or the cooling system or the case or the motherboard. It's just there are many, many choices out there. And you have to also make sure that they're all compatible with each other, even though there are standards pretty much everywhere in the PC space. So, you know, you can more or less take any graphics card and put it in any motherboard like that has been created in the recent amount of years. And it all works thanks to standards like PCI and so on. So that's a really great thing about the whole ecosystem, is that even though there are so many different companies creating all these products, they all interoperate. But they also influence each other, where if you get like a more powerful CPU, well, that's going to generate more heat. And then you have to make sure you get that heat out of your system somehow through cooling and through airflow and so on. And as we know from being Mac users who have used Intel processors and recently, they do get quite hot. And yeah. I am using an Intel processor here in this new system, and I did manage to cool it using a quite sophisticated liquid cooling solution, which Ooh. I'm very happy with. So that it turns out you are able to cool an Intel chip with the right cooling that wouldn't fit in a MacBook, that's for sure. But I did spend a lot of time doing research, and like you said, there was a lot of conflicting advice. I basically used, I would say, 3 YouTube channels as my main kind of source of research. And I found that those 3 gave me a good kind of well-rounded view of what was available. And they had good tutorials and good reviews of individual components and with good benchmarking and things like that. And then I could kind of cross-check that and do more research around that as well to just double check everything. Because, you know, if it's one thing that I've learned being on the internet for so many years is that you always want to double check, even if you really trust some particular reviewer, you always want to get like a second opinion to make sure, you know, it's something that's suited for your use case, not just for their use case. But the three YouTube channels I use the most, I would say, is Austin Evans' YouTube channel, which is really, really good. He has really good tutorials about actually building PCs. Like he had one video that was called like building a gaming PC in 2022, which is one of the first videos I watched. And I found that to be very, very informative. Then there's Gamers Nexus, which is a great YouTube channel. They have so many reviews about components. So everything from cases to CPUs, GPUs, motherboards, they really do a lot of benchmarking and very kind of thorough reviews around every aspect of the performance, which was really good for just double checking that the components I was considering were actually good and that they would work well. And then also Linus Tech Tips. They also had some really good videos around both reviews and things like that, but also just things to think about and tutorials of how to actually put together computers. So those three channels are, and plus a lot of other kind of researching online and things like that, really gave me a good overview of not only how do you build a gaming PC, but also like how do you pick the different components and how do you make sure that, for example, your cooling is sufficient and your case is big enough to house your giant GPU and how that would all work together.
Really nice. And what are the results like? So you mentioned plugging into a TV, which I think most PC gamers are probably using like an actual PC monitor and playing like FPS games or something like that. And you are using your PC more like you'd use a console. And tell us about the whole experience with the TV and the actual performance of the machine.
Sure. So yeah, I'm basically treating this still as a console. It's like my own homemade console that I built specifically for me, which is really cool.
Nice.
But it is plugged into the TV, and I do have a mouse and a keyboard like tucked away in the living room that I can just bring up to just like do admin work in Windows, like to set things up, to log in to the computer and so on. But then I put all of that away, and then I just use the controller. So I have my Xbox controller connected to the PC. I bought a little adapter that you can just plug into USB port, which basically makes the PC act like an Xbox in that it communicates with the controller with low latency, and you have all the features that you would expect from the controller, which is really nice. And the cool thing is that Windows is actually really well designed to work well with an Xbox controller. Like you push the Xbox button, like the main button, which would be like the PlayStation button on a PlayStation controller, and it brings up this overlay, and then you can just quick switch between different games. You can jump into the Xbox app, which has like Game Pass and all of those services that you have on Xbox. It automatically syncs most of your saves. So I could pick up a lot of games I was playing on Xbox directly on the PC without losing my saves, which was awesome.
Nice.
And all of that, like, really great experience. And then just like sometimes I have to use the mouse to like switch maybe to Steam, which is another store that you can use to buy games. And then I, you know, launch a game from there with the mouse. And then I just use the controller again, because the vast majority of all PC games work super well with the controller. So the actual experience of playing the game with the controller is more or less identical to when I used to play on console, which was definitely a goal I wanted to achieve, and I feel like that I've achieved. In terms of the performance, I went for, I would say, a quite high-end system. I didn't use like the very highest end components I could possibly get, because I did have some budget constraints I wanted to follow because, you know, I didn't want to go too far out. But I did build a quite high-end system, so it is running, I would say, the vast majority of current games at actually not just 60 frames per second, but 120 frames per second. So really maxing out my LG TV's number of frames it can render, because 120 hertz TV. I can run with ray tracing on and at 4K. Really, really beautiful graphics. And I've been revisiting some games that I already played on console now with the latest settings, and yeah, it just looks incredible. So I'm very, very happy about the performance and the graphics. And also, like I mentioned, that some games I wanted to play that were older titles that hadn't been updated, just ran with like the last generation settings on my Xbox, I can now run those with max settings on my PC because now I have full control.
Nice.
So it all turned out really, really well. And I've been playing it now for a couple of weeks and it's been really, really amazing so far. So I'm very, very happy I went through with this and built this PC.
So there are two more topics we need to cover because we're talking about a PC and you can't talk about an Intel PC and not talk about temperatures.
Right.
And also I want to hear about Windows itself and any interesting or weird experiences in there, but tell us about the temperatures first.
Sure. So like you said, you definitely have to keep track of the temperatures when you're dealing with an Intel CPU, as we know, because our MacBooks used to get really, really hot before there was Apple Silicon. And this Intel chip, so I have the latest Core i7 processor, the 13th generation, and it does get really, really hot. So, but I do have liquid cooling here in this computer, and I do also have quite good airflow. I installed a total of 6 fans on the computer case itself. Wow. To get really good airflow. Plus, you have the water cooling. So that makes it possible to actually manage that heat really, really well. So I would say the CPU doesn't run hotter than usually, like, I would say 50, 60 degrees, something like that.
Ooh.
Which is well below, like, the maximum limit is 100 degrees, right?
Yeah.
So that's works really, really well. But games also usually aren't very CPU bound. They're usually GPU bound because, you know, I'm really pushing the graphics to the maximum here. Like my GPU is usually running at like 100% utilization, but the CPU will usually be around, I would say, somewhere between 20, 30, 40% utilization in a game. Sometimes even lower than that, depending on what kind of game it is.
Yeah, that sounds like you have quite a bit of headroom for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the CPU will probably last me a really, really long time, unless there's some big revolution in CPU technology or something like that. But for now, I'm managing it really well. Like, it has really good power and good performance, and the heat is being transferred efficiently out of the system, so it's not throttling and things like that, which was very, very common for Intel CPUs to do when you were running in a very, you know, small enclosed case like a MacBook Pro.
Yeah, definitely. And finally, Windows. How's that these days? Because it's been a while since... Well, I actually used that laptop a while back, so I got a bit of the modern Windows experience, but what's it been like? What was your like previous Windows experience, like Windows 95 or something?
Yeah, pretty much. I think Windows 95 or 98 maybe, or XP, I think it was. XP was like probably my latest... Windows experience. So things have changed quite a lot since then. But it's very funny. I mean, people make this joke about Windows and it's absolutely true, which is that all of the old versions of Windows are still there in the latest version of Windows, like Windows 11.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Windows 11, for example, there's a settings app, which looks very, very nice. I would say it pretty much looks better than the Mac settings app these days in terms of like the structure and the icons and so on. It's very, very nice. But then all of a sudden, you need to tweak some setting, and it's not there in the settings app. So you're like, okay, where do I go now? Well, it turns out there's also the control panel,
ooh,
which is like the older settings app. And then it looks like you're back in Windows XP again. And then you can go from there to like an even older setup, for example, for user configuration. And then you're like almost back in Windows 95. So you can kind of go back in time depending on what you want to tweak. Like the bad news about that is that it's sometimes really hard to find the settings. And it looks very inconsistent. But the good news is that you can usually tweak whatever you want, because that's a benefit of Windows, I would say, and why it works so well for gaming. Because, you know, for example, I'm able to install things like I can have an overlay running when I'm playing games if I want to, which is showing like all the metrics, like the CPU and GPU utilization, the fan speed, the temperature, so I can keep track of it if I want to. That you can just install tools like that super easily. You have complete control over like almost the entire OS, it feels like. There's also all sorts of plugin support and so on. So those are some benefits, but the downsides is that the user experience is really, really fragmented. And while you're in Windows 11 land, I would say overall things look really, really nice. And they're like modern and nice. I would say I would still not want to switch to Windows for actual productivity work, for actually like doing my work. For gaming, it's fine, but I still definitely prefer macOS for productivity. But I would say Windows 11 is super nice in terms of the design and the overall user experience. It's just that like you very often have to like go below that beautiful, nice layer of Windows 11 to the older layers to achieve certain things. And then, yeah, it's you really can tell that, okay, it's still still Windows like it used to be back in the day.
Yeah, definitely matches my experience. But yeah, good to know that it's mostly been a fun experience. And again, you're mostly running games, so games usually take over the machine when they're running in full screen, so you don't really have to worry too much about what's underneath.
Exactly. And, you know, apart from just tweaking some login settings and, you know, installing the drivers, which is another fun thing you have to do on Windows, right? Like, you know, when I first plugged in my GPU, for example, it was like rendering in some compatibility mode. It was super low resolution and didn't, you know, render anything fancy. And then when I install like the NVIDIA drivers, because I have an NVIDIA GPU, then all of a sudden it like turned into 4K, like as soon as the drivers were installed, and it was like beautiful and perfect. Nice. So yeah, a lot of manual work you have to do to kind of set everything up on Windows, and it's particular for gaming. But like I mentioned, I am actually happy to do that kind of stuff now, because I'm interested in the underlying, like how everything works. And that's also why I wanted to build this computer, to kind of more understand how things work on the hardware level. And I feel like I really achieved that. And yeah, really looking forward to kind of tweak this machine and the experience going forward as I continue playing games on it.
Awesome.
So also, I just want to wrap up by saying, if anyone wants to hear more details around like what components I used or anything like that, just feel free to ping me on Mastodon. I'm more than happy to share any learnings from doing this. Like I said, I went from not knowing anything about how PCs are built, I mean, apart from knowing like that there's a CPU and a GPU and RAM, to actually learning and building successfully the computer. And it did start on the first attempt as well. So I did do something right, and it's been working really well so far. So if anyone wants to kind of hear more about this journey, then feel free to ping me and I'll be happy to share more details there.
Awesome.
Great. But that's it for this episode of Stack Trace. So hope you enjoyed this final episode of 2022. We will be back again in January 2023. But until then, thanks so much for listening, everybody. And you can find us online. I would say the best place right now is probably to find us on Mastodon, right, Rambo?
Yep, I am at _inside on mastodon.social.
And I am at John Sundell on mastodon.social as well. So feel free to find us there and ping us there. We love to talk to people online, and Mastodon, I feel like so far, is really, really great. Like there's so much of the community there now, and it feels very nice to talk to people there. So feel free to follow us and ping us there. And of course, this being the last episode of the year, all that remains is for us to wish everybody a very, very happy new year, very nice holiday season. Thanks so much for listening to Stack Trace throughout this year. We really appreciate your support, and we love doing the show. So have a great holiday season, and we will talk to you again on the next episode in 2023. Until then, say Happy New Year, Mr. Rambo.
Happy New Year.